are becoming extinct, which means that their species is dying off, which is very sad.
Everybody on tape? Good. You're taping right now? All right.
From Seattle, the Earth on the Air Radio Works presents Earth on the Air.
That's how it is out here.
There are, by some estimates, about 30 million different species of plants and animals living on Earth.
But we've only identified about 1.5 million.
And largely because of the impact of a growing human population, species are going extinct faster than we can name them.
In the next half hour, Earth on the Air's grassroots contributors take a look at why some people are so dedicated to protecting species we know to be in danger.
We'll hear stories of wolves and bears and the plight of the smaller, lesser-noticed creatures.
We'll climb a mountain with the Forest Service, hooting for a northern spotted owl.
First, a trip to Hokkaido in Japan, where Shima Fukuro resides, the largest owl on Earth and one of the most endangered. The tape was submitted by producer Guy Nelson.
My name is Toshio Oda. Ainu people, they believe many get...
Toshio Oda is an Hokkaido naturalist and anthropologist. The Ainu people, and the natives of Hokkaido, Toshio Oda says,
for example,
believe in many gods.
Shima Fukuro,
and the top god is Shima Fukuro.
Top god.
Sometimes known as Blakeston's fish owl.
Shima Fukuro protect Ainu people. Food cycle.
Within the food cycle, Shima Fukuro sits on top of the pyramid, so Shima Fukuro plays a leading role in keeping the life cycle in balance. Owl expert Sumio Yamamoto demonstrates male and female Shima Fukuro calls. The female is generally bigger than the male, weighing about 12 pounds. Its wingspan can reach 1.8 meters. In all of Hokkaido, there are maybe 100 of the birds. Another 1,000 live in Russia and South Korea. In America, there are about 5,000 spotted owls. But if we protect the owl, then forestry loses jobs. Japan and America should think together about this problem. If your country finds a solution, please tell me. I want to learn.
The spotted owl conservation issue in the States has really attracted major public attention.
Mark Brazil is an ornithologist living in Japan.
Whereas the issue here, Blakiston's fish owl, is not a catchy bird here. People don't know about it. So we're not talking about being able to mobilize large numbers of people, and publicity, particularly for this species, has been very poor. The major issue is whether habitat can be practically set aside for the species, and this really is a gap in conservation and even thought in Japan, is that whilst the bird itself is designated as a special natural monument, that doesn't really protect the habitat that it requires. Owls are top predators. They're obviously excellent indicators of the quality of our environment. If our planet can't support other species, particularly other top predators, then the human environment begins to look very dodgy.
I don't know what you want to get into here.
And in the United States...
Michael Anders, until recently, worked for the Forest Service. He's now gone on to work on his graduate studies. He took me on a Forest Service campout high in the mountains above Ashland, Oregon. Three crews of two people each fanned out across a single bowl to try to contact the northern spotted owl they suspected was living in the area.
This is a ridge line. Everything south of this ridge line right here feeds into the watershed that feeds into Ashland Creek that provides the water source for Ashland.
These are mostly dug firs around here?
Mostly dug fir, some white fir here and there.
And it's good habitat because it's pretty good canopy?
Yeah, it's pretty small trees right here, but it's closed canopy enough that it gives them protection. especially over here in this direction. See, so we'll make camp here and hoot out in this direction.
So not a lot of hiking tonight.
Efforts like this one occur regularly throughout the Pacific Northwest. Because the spotted owl is listed as a threatened species, the Forest Service is charged with monitoring the bird's habitats so that those areas can be protected from logging.
2107. So I'll stop.
Woo! 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 Woo!
We heard him.
Okay, turn your radio back on at 5:30 and we'll hoot from over here. And then we'll probably do the follow-up from over here if you guys just want to hang out and we'll see what we find.
Copy.
What's going to happen tomorrow?
We're going to go out and try and find the owl that's responding right now and locate it and determine whether there's a pair or whether it's a single, whether there's babies, so forth like that, and then we'll feed it some mice, and that's one way to determine whether it has a nest, whether it has babies, because it'll take the mice to the babies.
A lot of people might think that this is a lot of effort. You know, you've got two teams out here camping out for two nights and sophisticated radio equipment and compasses getting bearings on one hoot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, does it really do anything?
Well, it helps us. It's just about the only way we can establish where the owls are, how many there are. It's not just bringing attention to a species and an animal that's sensitive, but it's bringing attention to how much timber can we take. It's pretty obvious that so far we're not cutting in a sustainable way, you know, but the owls are bringing a lot of attention to that whole issue.
But the Forest Service isn't just tracking owls. It's just what's getting a lot of attention. You're out tracking plants and other species.
That's
too,
right? Yeah. Plants and all kinds of different wildlife, whether it's cranes or eagles or elk or coyotes, and even nowadays wolves. We're starting to have to howl for wolves.
Yeah?
Yeah. Because when you remove the timber, you're removing the base resource that provides food for these animals that are secondary predators or primary predators. And it takes time to recognize how these different animals are being affected, whether or not they're declining in numbers, because it doesn't just happen right away, you know.
Yeah.
Conservationists are lobbying to expand 1973's Endangered Species Act to provide direct protection for whole ecosystems. Meanwhile, scientists are looking for better ways of monitoring a forest's health than relying solely on the much-maligned spotted owl. In Montana, the Park Service is watching the decline of beetle populations, for example. Just about any species can be thought of as an indicator of the health of its environment. In Washington State, the Environmental Protection Agency is finding that frogs provide an accurate barometer for many environmental systems. Wildlife biologist Klaus Richter is in charge of the frog research. He says the global decline of amphibian populations is alarming, but that it will take some effort to spread the word. Richter was interviewed by producer Mary Darling.
We have what we consider to be reasonably good protection of vertebrates, of the mammals and of the birds, and it's only recently that we've been looking at amphibians and trying to get protection for amphibians as well. But it's very difficult to get protection for some of these species because what happens is developers are just going to say, well, you know, we've already given you protection for species A, B, and C. We've given you land for mammals. We have given you land for birds, and now here you're coming in the door again, and what you now are telling us you want protection for a frog or for amphibians. When is this ever going to end? Well, it's just that we've been emphasizing our regulations and our protection for the animals in which the public is familiar with, and now what we need to do is familiarize them with some of the lesser known animals and try to get some protection for them, because although they're lesser known, they're ecologically just as important and maybe even more important than the species that we're currently protecting.
How many people are going to worry about a tiny spotted carob beetle in the Amazon jungle?
Peter Douglas Ward is a paleontologist concerned about modern extinctions.
You can make the case of the mosquito. If the Anopheles mosquito, which produces malaria and so much pain and suffering, could be driven to extinction, if you had the power of God, would you do it? And most scientists say, well, yes, I would.
What's the danger of losing species? Why should we be concerned?
Well, there's a couple of different ways to look at that. One is in terms of ethics. Let's say that you go find a Leonardo da Vinci painting and watch it get destroyed. You're seeing something that is of great antiquity. You're seeing something that was created only with enormous difficulty destroyed from the face of the earth. There's an ethical quandary here. Why would one destroy such a beautiful piece of art? In the same way, species are now the long result of tremendous eons of geological time. And so when you are killing off a species today, what you are doing is chopping off the end of a huge tree. In many respects, that species may never be replaced by anything equivalent. In terms of our own self-centered nature, there are many species which could be of great benefit to mankind. We have as yet to tap into the vast pharmaceutical potentialities of tropical plants, for instance, and we have no idea what other animal species may or may not do for man's good. I tend to dislike those arguments. I understand them. I think species have every right to existence for just being here, not because they can somehow in the future be of the welfare to the better good of mankind.
Peter Douglas Ward was interviewed by Susan Gleason.
One of the world's oldest living creatures is the Colorado squawfish. It's been around for about 40 million years, and it's now on the brink of extinction. Producer Pete Simon looks at Colorado efforts to save the fish.
A half hour west of Grand Junction, a lonely stretch of the Colorado River is dotted with cottonwood trees and thick tamarisk underbrush. It's normally a peaceful scene, but construction crews have been shattering the serenity, digging acre-sized holes for six retainer ponds near the river. By spring, the ponds will be a protected home for squawfish and three other endangered fish that live in the river. Frank Pfeiffer, a fish biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, says the ponds are being built to ensure that the fish survive.
If we had a catastrophic event, chemical pollutants or whatever would get into the Colorado River, they could not wipe out the entire fish. We would have some left as a gene pool to work with to try to recover them.
The new ponds are part of a 15-year, $53 million effort to increase the shrinking numbers of squawfish. The decline is partly due to poor public perception that was reinforced in the 1960s by government literature that referred to squawfish as trash fish. Bill Haggerty of the State Division of Wildlife says squawfish would be appreciated more if people understood the history of the Colorado Basin.
There were entire Indian nations that supported themselves on squawfish once white man wiped out the buffalo and the elk. It were the squaws in the river with pitchforks, literally pitchforking enough squawfish out of the river to keep their men alive and their whole villages alive.
Early white settlers raved about squawfish, calling them white salmon. They were the area's best eating fish. Some grew to be 6 feet long and weighed up to 80 pounds. Today, the relatively few remaining squawfish grow up to 4 feet and top out at 15 pounds. Why had the number and size of this fish declined so dramatically? Several miles upstream from the eastern stretches of the Grand Valley, river water falls over a 12-foot-high concrete wall that extends 100 yards across the Colorado River. It's one of over 3 dozen dams built over the years that divert water into canals for farms, homes, and cities, making lush green fruit orchards, hay fields, and lawns possible. Frank Pfeiffer says not until long after the dams and canals were built did anyone think about the insurmountable spawning problems they cause for the fish.
They were normally able to migrate basically any place in the system they wanted to go. They are now restricted to certain reaches because the dams have blocked their migration routes.
That's why the Fish and Wildlife Service is building an experimental fish ladder at a dam site near Grand Junction. Another big problem that people created for squawfish was the introduction of non-native fish, which have crowded out the native population. Since the early 1900s, first private citizens and then the Fish and Wildlife Service have stocked the basin with non-native species. Bass, northern pike, channel catfish, crappies, perch, and brown trout. They eat many of the insects and plankton that used to be eaten solely by native fish. One of Grand Junction's busiest sporting goods stores is Gene Taylor's. Frank Jimenez works here, and part of his job is to advise customers on where the good fish are biting. For 25 years, Jimenez has fished for channel catfish on a stretch of river between Grand Junction and Moab, and the diminishing number of squawfish doesn't bother him at all.
They become such a nuisance for the fishermen down. You can catch 6 to 8 squawfish to any catfish you catch.
Jimenez echoes the sentiment of hundreds of fishermen who are tired of having to throw back the endangered squawfish when they'd rather land something else. But Bill Haggerty at the State Division of Wildlife points out that the non-native catfish thrive in the only stretch of the Colorado Basin where the squawfish continue to do well.
You got to keep it in perspective. This might be your one little fishing hole, but it happens to be the only place in the world where these fish can still survive.
The deadliest blow to Colorado squawfish came in the early 1960s, well before Congress passed the Endangered Species Act. To clear over 100 miles of river to be stocked with trout, fish and wildlife personnel dumped potent amounts of rotenone into the Green and San Juan rivers. Rotenone removes oxygen from water. Thousands of native fish were killed. Today, the Fish and Wildlife Service admits this effort to improve sport fishing was ill-advised. In the San Juan River, the Endangered Species Act has been enforced to protect squawfish and has altered construction of the massive Animas La Plata water project. The Fish and Wildlife Service Squawfish Recovery Program expires next year, but the fish will remain on the endangered list until more substantial populations are restored. To the dismay of nature enthusiasts, fishermen, and water developers alike, the recovery is expected to take decades. Bill Haggerty of the State Division of Wildlife has hope for the squawfish.
You know, like you say, they're not getting much over 4 feet. Hey, pick me, I'll catch a 4-foot fish any time, you know.
This is Pete Simon.
American gray wolves used to roam from the Arctic to Mexico. Now, because of habitat destruction, hunting, poisoning, and trapping, gray wolves occupy less than 1% of their former range and have been reduced to 0.1% of their original population. Producer Lowell Harvey visited Wolf Haven, a sanctuary for wolves outside of Olympia, Washington.
Now, one thing is when we go in here, we basically are going to be wolves for a while because these guys see us as funny-looking upright wolves for the most part.
Chris Mann leads our tour into wolf territory, several acres divided into a series of large fenced enclosures.
There's the other one. There's the other one.
Hi, Kathleen. Oh. There we go. Hello, guys. Kathleen over there on the left is what we call a buffalo wolf. And in another 10 years or so, so when you guys are in high school, basically, there won't be any more wolves like Kathleen anywhere. There are fewer than 20 buffalo wolves living today, and they all seem to be interrelated. So if we were to try and breed them as just buffalo wolves, that particular subspecies, there would be a whole lot of inbreeding problems down the road. So once these few are gone, that will be it. The federal government has stopped acknowledging the buffalo wolf as an existing subspecies. They've already declared them extinct.
These three dozen odd wolves, mostly from closed down roadside zoos and private collections, would not survive in the wild. They will be cared for here for the rest of their lives. They now serve as ambassadors for their dwindling species. Steve Kuntz is Wolf Haven's founder and president.
People have been brought up throughout their whole lives, and especially in earlier years, where wolves were always painted as the bad guy. I mean, they were always the ones that hurt man or hurt his living or was in direct competition with man. What we do through our education is show them reasons why wolves and how wolves can coexist with humans and try to change that viewpoint a little bit of how the big bad wolf. Say the wolf, say the wolf.
After meeting the wolves, we gather around a campfire to hear stories and songs and learn wolf talk.
What you want to do is howling's down here in your chest, okay? And it's an sound, not a woo. It's not a woo-woo-woo, okay? It works best if the women and the kids go first, and then when I go like this, then you guys chime in, and maybe we'll get them going, okay? So on the count of three, one, two, three.
The people like it and the wolves like it. They like to answer. And it also builds a connection between them and the wolves. It makes them feel much better about wilderness. Therefore, they'll respect nature much more.
Oh, we got one. Okay.
We're training wildlife personnel. We're training our personnel, some of our volunteer forces. We're working with the University of Southern California in doing wolf surveys. And what that is wolves are coming back to Washington State and Idaho by themselves. But it's not known for sure if they're there, where they were prior to starting these howling brigades. And it's basically going out howling and waiting for responses. And we've been able to establish that there are wolves in both states, which will then provide a lot more protection. If you can prove they're there, then there's a lot more protection through the Endangered Species Act that they're there.
Wolf Haven often works cooperatively with wildlife agencies, but it is currently at odds with one of them. The Wildlife Division of Alaska is planning a program that would kill off a third of the state's wolf population each year. Steve Kuntz says state legislators are catering to sport hunters who compete with wolves for common prey. Wolf Haven, he says, has been lobbying to stop the program.
Say the wolves, say the wolves.
Susan Zwinger wanted to, as she put it, live close to an elemental power, close to what is essential. So she took a solitary odyssey through the wilderness of Alaska. It's recorded in her book, Stalking the Ice Dragon.
We're part of the ecosystem. We don't think we are anymore. We think we can use it, but we function best when we live in close symbiotic relationship with all the plants and animals. I don't separate myself out I am one of the animals. You yourself as a human have to put in some cost in creeping through the woods, stumbling through the marsh, being cold, being wet. And thus when you finally see that animal, particularly when you've been out hiking all day long and haven't seen anything, and you finally see the animal, there is a really powerful feeling that goes on. Maybe even a bonding, because you've been physically doing more what the animal has to be doing. I don't think you can sit home and watch PBS.
In her book, Zwinger writes of trekking through pure Arctic tundra in the Brooks Range.
Exhausted after the long tundra hike, I collapse, never to move again. At least until against the dark gray stone wall, white dots are moving, dull dots. 1 mile along a precarious edge, I move in closer, until those dots develop legs, sheep legs. I look again. I can't believe my eyes. A dark figure lumbers after them. Wolf? No, too large. Bear. Huge white slash down its side and the muscular hump means grizzly. My hands shake. My circulation stops. Adrenaline zings out to my fingertips and toes. Not from fear, but from respect. The magnificence of beast at the top of the food chain, elder bear to Native Americans. There is, they tell us, a human inside of each bear who is here to share his wisdom and power with us. This is true, absolutely. Legend says that grizzly taught humankind everything we know about living in the North. He was brother bear. Just as it came time to disclose the secret of hibernation, we grew impatient and killed the bear. Now we must remain awake throughout the long, cold, dark winter in dank houses. I now think as the hunter bear, crawling into his bear skin and wandering in his bear mind and bear body, crossing steep scree, the pads of my feet sore on the volcanic stone. There is nausea in the pit of my stomach. Muscles ache with it. I will sleep deeply, not fully hibernate, without urinating or eating beginning the end of September, just a month away. Just one fat sheathed sheep could make all the difference. Now I must come out of my hibernation prematurely and scavenge the steep winter snows. I hurtle through tundra in the dusk, seeing in my brain's eye the blood-twitching red meat, the delicious fat hanging in drapes inside the skin. I feel my powerful jaws crushing down on the skull with delight, the brain squirting out protein-rich caviar, that greasy, thick wool caught in my teeth. I, as human woman, will come back, greatly changed, looking to predators for my answers.
Susan Zwinger, reading from her book, Stalking the Ice Dragon.
That's the show. Thanks for tuning in.
Don't forget, this is your program, too. We invite you to take part in Earth on the Air's ongoing radio dialogue.
Find out about becoming a member of the Earth on the Air Radio Works and receive a copy of our submission guidelines.
Write us at P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145.
Earth on the Air Submissions Director is Susan Gleason. Our Executive Director is Craig McDonald. The show is produced and edited by Peter Mulloff and Suzanne Tedesco, and engineered by Scott Bergen.
We had additional help from John Loggins, Peter Young, Chris Wade, Betsy Levy, Winona Wilson, and Spencer Ante.
Also thanks to KOW, KCMU, and the Dub Train, cassette duplicating services in Seattle.
Music was from Earth Tunes, Harry Levine, David Hines, and Randy.
Production facilities provided by Jack Straw Productions in Seattle.
Partial funding was from the Town Creek Foundation and the Mary Reynolds Babcock Foundation.
If you'd like a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-800-3145. Mention that you'd like program number 26. For the Earth on the Air Radio Works, this is Janice Kane.
And I'm Peter Mulloff.